be a laying on of hands after this meeting. And all of you now realize what a challenge it has been to sponsor David for 29 years and 10 months, exactly. My name is Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. Been sober since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. This was accomplished by people like you and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a number of interesting things happen this week. I walked up to this floor on Monday, and there was a sign that says, "No alcohol beyond this point." I thought they were going to lock us up. They've now turned it around and keeps drunken for coming in, and we don't like that either, so whatever. I have been given instructions this evening. Lee, the taper, CD-er. Lee, the CD-er, has given me a set of signals. At 10 minutes before I'm supposed to stop, which I think is what, 30 minutes? Something like that. He's going to give me 10 minutes. At 35 minutes, he's going to give me 5 minutes. If I go 5 minutes more, he's going to... At which time there will be an alarm and you're all supposed to leave the building as quickly as you can. I want to thank you all for letting me speak here. I've been coming here for a while, and I really have always enjoyed this conference. I like the outdoors. I've enjoyed the fishing. I've enjoyed tennis and golf and all the good talks that I've heard in the program and the workshops. And it's just been a really great thing for me. And I think it's been a helpful thing to a lot of families, and it's been a pleasure to be a part of that. It's been really good. I'm an alcoholic. I told you that. It's a little difficult for people to sometimes understand what an alcoholic is. And there have been a lot of dogs up here. Have you seen the dogs? I had a dog once. The dog's name was Patches. He was mostly an English bulldog. He, most all the time, was an even-tempered, loving dog. But he had a side to him that was rather different. He was a hero because he had found a badger up in the field one day and fought that badger for about an hour before he finally killed the badger. The badger weighed 1 pound more than he did. Everybody heard about that, and they thought, that's a great dog. Great dog. He didn't have any competition. He was well loved, fed, ears scratched, all kinds of good things. He was laying in our barnyard one morning when this story began. A big boar hog came into our yard. And Patches made a bulldog-like decision about the hog. He decided to get hold of the hog. He did not make that decision lightly. He went sailing into that hog and caught hold of him, and the hog began to squeal. The dog began to bark. My dad came running out of the shop, finding out what in the hell's going out of there. I saw my dog going into that thing, and I had to get in there and try to get him out. My mother saw the kid going into the fight. She was there. Everybody in the barnyard had a problem. All of us had a problem. The hog dragged him alongside the barn long enough to make him come off. And when he did that, Dad got hold of him, picked him up, carried him to the water hydrant, sent me to the barn to get some pine tar to put on the cuts. The hog had cut him up pretty good when he turned him loose. Poured water on him, and everybody took a deep breath. Peace in the barnyard. So Dad turned him loose. He went right back and caught hold of the hog again. And it was the same thing. There was barking and squealing and cussing and kicking and mothers wringing their hands and I'm trying to get my dog out of there. Everybody knows the problem. Patches, turn loose the damn hog. Turn him loose. Hog knows it. We know it. Everybody knows that's the problem. He comes off again. Dad gets him again. This time, Dad takes him to the water hydrant and chains him up to the water hydrant, runs water on him, cools him off, gets him to pick off, and removes the temptation. You know, if you get rid of the temptation, that often solves the problem. And he drove the pig up back to the neighbor's house, the hog back to the neighbor's house. And I was given the job of being, Patch's counselor. I sat beside him and talked to him and gave him deep and penetrating thoughts about what was going on. Things like, you know, do your family enjoy it when you get hold of hogs? Did you ever have a good day getting hold of a hog? Why do you persist in getting hold of hogs? Well, Dad came back and went back to the shop, and about an hour or so, I had Patches laying on the ground again. He wasn't tugging at the chain. His tongue was out, you know, that little tongue sticking out like they do, a little smile on his face. He was easy, little tail was wagging about like that. So I went and told Dad, I think Patches is well. Dad said, I want to look at him. He's given me a fair amount of trouble this morning. So he came and looked at him. He walked around him, scratched his ear. Patches panted a little bit and had the grin on his face. And Dad said, okay, turn him loose. So we turned him loose. Patches had to go 2 miles to find that hog again. Now, do any of you identify with any of the players in this game? I was the first Hogganon in West Texas.
Can you start all the way over?
Okay. My name is Jerry Jones. Does anybody miss any part of the hog show? Anyway, I was the first Hogganon in West Texas. Some of you may identify with one of the other players. I did after a while. Some of you caught hold of the hog and went back. Now, it turned out it wasn't hogs at all. A little bit later, he caught hold of a cattle truck. Just once. Some of you, not you, but some of your friends, have caught hold of a cattle truck. And that's what we're dealing with. A physical reaction to alcohol, which makes us mentally and physically different than our fellows. When we start to drink, when I start to drink, I think the thought comes to my mind, I think I'll have another one of those. And I have another one and another one until I've had too many. And when I stop and wake up again, I have an obsession. An obsession is a great big thought. It pushes all the other thoughts out of your head. And you say, whatever it is, a drink would improve this situation, and you go again. And you've heard some great speakers this week who talk about this obsession and this disease, both as an Al-Anon, and God, I wish my wife could have heard your tape when I believe I could have stretched that drink in another year or two. She thought I was the damn problem. And if I could cover the ground over here that Hilda did, my God, I've never heard a running drunk like that one in my life. And I got to spend some time with Don. Don and I shared. We told about the cases we had won. From what we heard, Sharon probably listened to this and concluded from the back seat that neither one of us had ever lost a case. But it was good. It was good. Yeah. And we have a good time with this thing. It's a marvelous place where we can go and talk about our weaknesses and be free and communicate with one another and understand one another. And we create a fellowship, a company of equals is what I think that's defined as. And we go forward with this thing. I didn't have that kind of idea as a young man. What was I like? Well, I don't know where this came from. But I grew up in a farm in West Texas. And when I was 10 years old, World War II started, and all the able-bodied men went to war. And kids like me were driving tractors and pickups and doing the work raising crops. And my dad couldn't do a lot. He had arthritis, and so I got a good dose of responsibility. And pretty quick, I found the solution to responsibility. Irresponsibility is a great relief. Now, I hadn't had a drink wouldn't have a drink for a number of years. But I drove fast. I did wild and crazy things. I shot insulators off a telephone post. I shot holes in mailboxes. I would have been a great juvenile delinquent if the people in Bovina had just known what that was. And that followed me. And to some extent, I think it still follows me. It's kind of deeply ingrained. I really always had a big sense of responsibility. I watched my mother and father, and they were responsible people. Neither of them drank. Neither of them ever lied that I knew about. Neither of them ever broke a law that I knew about. And then I came along. And I went the other way with the irresponsible side of this thing. And when I got to college, that was the first time I had a drink. And I liked it. I liked it. My God, it was no time at all till I had a blackout, which I thought everybody did. I thought that was a part of the act. And I liked the mystery of drinking. Waking up in the morning and saying, "Where are we?" Followed closely by, "What did we do?" And we could kind of piece together something after a while, and everybody laughed a little bit. And I was the guy who said, "Let's do it again. Let's go get her one more time. What do you think, huh?" Now, I met my wife in college. I remember the first time I saw her. I lived near the woman's dormitory, one of the woman's dormitories. I lived in the pool hall penthouse, we called it, over the top of the campus pool hall. And she was on the corner, sitting on her suitcase. Long, beautiful hair, good-looking lady. She attracted my attention. I didn't have to be persuaded. I was attracted into this deal. But of me, she would have none. Right away, she found out I was professing my love for some young lady one night under the window at the damn dormitory, and she heard me, and I was pretty slurry, couldn't stand up much. And she decided I was not a candidate. She did not recognize my potential. So I pursued her. But the only thing I could get from her was her notes. I didn't attend a lot of classes. And when we had a class together, she would loan me her notes, which was really handy when you get around to taking finals and things like that. You get a clue I always sold my books right away. Dad would give me the money for the books, and I'd just walk around to the other side of the bookstore and sell them right back to him at a discount. But I'd have enough money for a little partying, you know. And so I was ill-equipped to pass courses. I didn't worry a lot about that. And she liked to borrow my car. So we had sort of a symbiotic relationship there. She loaned me cars, and I used her note-taking to get me through college, some of it anyway. I graduated from college, did not intend to graduate from college. Never had it in mind at all. They bring a new crop of freshman girls in there every year. Why in the hell would you want to leave? One of my roommates came around one day and said, "What are you going to do when you graduate?" I said, "Graduate? I'm not going to graduate." He said, "Oh, yes, you are. You're getting ready to graduate." And he said, I said, well, I don't know. I guess I'm going to go in harm. And he said, no, you don't have to do that. You can take a test, and if you pass the test, you can go to officer's candidate school in the Navy, and it'll be a better deal. So I take tests well. I can guess better than most people. So I passed the test, and I went to OCS, spent a while. They made you study up there. It was a strange phenomenon. You know, they really want you to know what they're trying to teach you. And Billy wasn't there to take notes, and so I just had to study. But I came back through, and she invited me to a Sadie Hawkins dance. You all probably don't know what that is, but that's where the girls invite the boys. And she saw me in that uniform. I didn't look bad. I didn't look bad. I began to look like I might have some prospects, you know, like potential. Anyway, she began to write me letters when I went back aboard ship, and I was gone for a while overseas, and I came back, and she had gone to California, which was her home at that time, and met the ship, and we had an 8 months courtship, something like that. Decided to get married. Now, she had an idea. My dad didn't drink after he got married. He had been a pretty good party boy. They told me stories about Dad. He took a dog to church one time to get him saved. created kind of a legend in that little country community. We had the only saved dog there was. But Dad married Mom, and he quit. Billy got the idea somewhere that when we got married, I was going to quit. God is my witness, I never even hinted to that. I never intended to give up drinking. I liked to drink. And she was disappointed in me. I continued to drink. I got out of the Navy, and I had a son by that time. And I couldn't find a job I liked, so I went to law school. And we worked our way through law school. And got a job in Dallas, Texas. Good job. And did well in law school. And I began to practice the life of a gentleman lawyer, which includes a few cocktails at the end of the day and that sort of thing. And that began to cause a little problems along the way. And from time to time, I would have to stay out after work, creating client relations. And I'd come home late. Well, I was a little tipsy, maybe. And she was crying one night. She told me she didn't get married to stay home and have me come dragging that in like that. And it wasn't a responsible thing for me to do. And that old sense of responsibility kicked right back in. So I quit going out. I just brought my booze home. And I don't have a real colorful story about drinking. I drank mostly at home. If I ever got drunk out, away from home, and embarrassed myself, I never went back to that place again. And when you drank as long as I did in Dallas, Texas, there was a lot of places you couldn't go. Then, really, a kind of a strange phenomenon occurred. First of all, she sent off to the Texas Commission on Alcoholism and got a test to see whether your loved one or you were alcoholic or had an alcohol problem. And she gave me the test and asked me if I would kindly take the test. And I did. I read the questions over carefully first, which is a good idea always, get kind of the scope and understanding of what they're trying to get at. And you pick out the ones you're going to pass and the ones you're going to flunk. And I passed the test just barely. I was a heavy drinker, but not an alcoholic. And I thought that would solve the problem, but she was pretty well obsessed with this thing about alcohol. She was overreacting pretty substantially. And a little later, I had to send her to a psychiatrist to try to get over this obsession she had. And the psychiatrist, you'd know it, wanted to get my side of the story. And I didn't answer many questions for him, but we talked about football and things like that. Malpractice for doctors who made misdiagnoses and things like that, you know. Well, I got out of there, and that would didn't end. You'd think that would end it, wouldn't you? It didn't. Strange things began to happen in my house. Now, I had a little trouble through these years. I had a bleeding stomach for no apparent cause. I got out, talked my way out of the hospital, and got Billy to take me home and went in to mix a drink because I hadn't had one in 2 or 3 days, and it was time for a drink. And I turned around and looked at her, and she was crying. And kindly, I asked her, "What in the hell's wrong with you?" She said, "I can't hardly stand to see you kill yourself." And I said, "Billy, shape up or ship out. I don't want to hear any more crap about this alcohol thing. I'm through with that. I'm not an alcoholic. I just drink a little more than most people maybe. But just by God, get off my back." She got in the car and drove around, and finally she came back in an hour or two and decided she would not ship out, she would stay. But she did something that was really, really off the wall. Without consulting me, without talking to me or giving me a hint at all, she began to go to a thing called Al-Anon. Al-Anon. I noticed that she wasn't there one time when I needed her. I didn't much care where she was except when I needed her. And when I needed her, by God, I wanted her right there, right now. I was a love to be with, I'll just say that. And my daughter was there, and I said, "Where's your mother?" She said, "Oh, I don't know, Daddy. She may have gone to one of those meetings." Now, at this point in time, we had decided mutually that if things did not improve in our relationship in the next 6 months, we'd just go ahead and get a divorce. Under those circumstances, when my wife was going to a meeting about which I had not been consulted or told, it occurred to me I better have a representative present at those damn meetings. There was no telling what they were getting ready to do to me. She came home. Now let me tell you another thing about my wife. She's the most difficult witness I ever cross-examined. She will not lie. But getting information from her is like trying to stab a snake with an ice pick. It's just really hard to do. And you could always tell when we're going to have one of those sessions, early in the conversation. I said, "Where have you been?" And she said, "Out." Right there, I knew what I was going to deal with the rest of the evening. Out where? To Preston Center. What did you do in Preston Center? Met with some friends. Who were they? You wouldn't know them. What did you and your friends talk about? Oh, we just shared our experience, strength, and hope. Well, it was going to be a long evening, and so what you do when you're cross-examining like that and you've got an evasive witness, you ask a question and close the door, another one and close the door, and you narrow the field of possible answers until you get what you want to know. And I ask her, finally, I got the word Al-Anon. Al-Anon. I had never heard of an Al-Anon. I didn't know what an Al-Anon was. And we were pretty angry by that time. And I didn't want to appear ignorant. So I made a good guess. I thought it might be an aluminum kitchen utensil. It isn't. Now, the lady who had nothing to say to me would not give me any information up to that point, began to talk. She told me more about Al-Anon in the next hour than I ever wanted to hear in my whole life. It was wonderful. It was a marvelous place. People would pay $500 for a seat in that place if they just knew how good it was. Anybody could go. Anyone was welcome in Al-Anon. And the fear began to come over me. I just made senior partner in the largest law firm in Dallas. They didn't know I had a problem, as far as I knew. We already had two alcoholics in my firm. They were talking about getting rid of them. And here I was, a young senior partner, minimal number of clients, with my wife going to a public meeting and declaring that I was an alcoholic. They're going to fire me soon, very, very soon. So I sat her down in the chair. And I explained this to her, that we had a very serious situation here. She needed to listen to me. Did she know that I was the only person who brought any money home to that place? She said, yes, I know that. I said, do you know what happens when you have debts that have to be paid on a monthly basis and you don't have any money to pay them? Well, what happens? Well, I said, you know, we have debts on everything. House, cars, furniture, any damn thing you can think of is in hock. And I said, if we don't pay those bills, they come and get those things. They take them away. And I said, you understand now, Billy, that when they find out that I'm in this thing, that you think I'm an alcoholic, they're going to call me in and fire me that day. And this is very serious. The money will stop. We'll be standing naked on the streets of Dallas with our children in the middle of the damn winter. And we're not talking about college education here. We're talking about survival. And she said, Jerry, I think I need to go. And I said, Billy, you may not go. And she said, Jerry, I think I'm going to go. And I said something loving like, if I ever go to another one of them damn meetings, I'll kill you just as sure as hell. And she said, I'm going. And I didn't kill her. As you can see, she's sitting right there. But she drove me crazy. Every day I went to work thinking, this is the day they're going to call me in and say, we understand. Your wife thinks you're an alcoholic. Do you want to tell us about that? And I did not want to tell them about that, because it wasn't true, of course. She had overreacted one more time. So I'd get to work and nothing would happen that day. But I didn't drink at work. I was clear-headed as I could be after an hour or two in the morning. And then I would stay as long as I could and go home. And on the way home, I would heave a sigh of relief and think, thank God they didn't call me in today. I got to get that woman out of Al-Anon. And I begged, please don't go there anymore. You're endangering our family. I'm not, but you are. And she said, and others I had, you know, I threatened her. I did all kinds of things. And I hate to tell you this. You know, you can look at me and tell what a gentleman lawyer I was. I intentionally started fights. On the way home, I would decide, okay, we're going to have a fight tonight. I'm going to run her out of Al-Anon tonight, by God. That's what I'm going to do. And the way you do that, and so you're sure you're going to win, you go in and you don't let them know there's going to be a fight. You begin to gather information which you're going to need to win the fight while they're still just casually doing whatever they're doing. So you walk in and you say, "Hi, darling, how are you?" She said, "Fine." I said, "Oh, dinner smells good." "Good." "How are the kids?" "Kids are fine." "How's the dog?" "Dog is good." "Billy, I've been thinking." "Oh, you think I'm an alcoholic?" And she said, "I don't know whether you are or not." I said, "Well, that's damn funny. You've been calling me an alcoholic for years." And she said, "Yes, but I was wrong." It makes no, you know, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what your mother and father think. It doesn't matter what your boss thinks. It doesn't matter what your clients think. It doesn't matter what anyone in the world thinks except you. And if you don't think you've got a problem with alcohol, you'll never do anything about it. And I made a mistake. A good trial lawyer should never ask a question when he doesn't know the answer. And I was a little curious, and I said, "Well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it?" And the jaws of the Al-Anon trap closed just like that. "Well," she said, she had an answer. She said, "I've been reading a book. The book is called The Primer on Alcoholism, and it's written by Marty Mann, who was the first woman member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in that book," she says, "people wonder whether they're alcoholics or not, and there is a way you can find out. What you do is very simple. You can quit entirely, and if you can stay quit, you're not an alcoholic. But I don't think that's what you want to do." And I said, "No, no, that's not what I want to do." "Hell no." She said, "But there's another thing you can do. You can simply drink 2 drinks every day for 6 months. And if you never exceed that amount, you are not an alcoholic." I said, "That's the dumbest damn test I've ever heard in my life." I said, "You've been trying to get me to quit drinking for years, and now you want me to drink for 6 more months? She said, "Yes, that's what I want you to do." And I realized I was dealing with a sick woman. She was being very inconsistent here. And I decided I wasn't getting anything out of this conversation. I'd just break it off. And I did, and I walked off, and I began to have a few drinks and think. And I thought about it a lot over the next couple of weeks. Finally, I decided somebody's got to save this damn family. I guess old Watash is going to have to do that. So I decided to take the damn test. Didn't tell anyone that I'm going to take the test. I just decided to take the test. 2 drinks wouldn't do me any good. But 3 drinks, I would take 3 drinks. I had a pretty good sized glass. And damnedest test you ever took. The more you cheat on it, the harder it is to pass. So I started taking the test. And I have 2 drinks. I knew she'd watch me. I didn't have to tell. She'd watch it. She watched all the time. And I'd have 1 drink. And I'd have the second drink. And I'd start the 3rd drink. What I was drinking mainly was deep dish green olive pies. Some people call those martinis. I'd soak those big old martinis up, and they do something for you. They're called silver bullets. They'll go right to the heart. And about the time I got through with that 3rd one, it would happen. It would happen. A thought would come in my mind. And the thought was almost like this, almost always like this. What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports all these damn people around here? Who has to go downtown and fight those other lawyers and them judges and them demanding clients? Who has to do that? Isn't a man of your character and case and status, isn't he entitled to have a couple of drinks when he comes home from work? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was hell no. Hell no. And I'd go to the bar and drink the bottle. I drank about a quart a day. I drank about a half a fifth of Beefeater's gin, quart, half quart. And then I'd switch to brandy because gentlemen drank brandy in the evening. Put just a little splash of soda in it, and I drank half a bottle of that. And then kind of coast off somewhere. It was a wonderful life. You know the movie? It was a wonderful life. Well, I'd start taking that. I'd go through that deal, you know, and I'd drink the bottle. Some days, I'd walk up to the bar, and I'd had a bad day. You've ever had a bad day? Just a bad day. And I'd say to myself, there ain't going to be no damn test today. And I'd drink the bottle. And I could literally forget it some days. I could put it out of my mind. But my wife had a sponsor. Gee, gods, what a sponsor she had. Meanest woman in the universe. She knew to hit you where it hurt so bad. She told Billy the way she should start each day. And moments she awakened, before she even opened her eyes, she should say, "This is the day the Lord has made. I shall rejoice and be glad in it." Now, when you had a quart of whiskey the night before, one of your eyes has been propped open for several hours and you have a case of dry eye. Your tongue could be shaved and you'd get a lot off of it. Your heart is beating up here in your head. You're sick at your stomach, and you hear that. You're reasonably sure you're not going to rejoice a lot that day. Painful days, painful days. I ran that test, gave it a good shot. Ran it a year and a half. Never passed that sucker one time, not once. I got to December 31st, 1972. My life was not going well. The doctor had just told me my liver was going. I had that bleeding stomach episode. I wasn't doing well at work. I was depressed. I didn't find anything much I liked to do, and I didn't see any prospect for things getting much better. I had achieved a lot in my life. It wasn't easy to make senior partner in that law firm, but I had done that. I'd worked through my way through law school. I'd made a good record. I supported my family. I had a nice house. I had cars. I had all kinds of things that I thought would make me happy. I was pursuing materialistic goals, and they were failing me. And I was trying to find comfort in alcohol, because I wanted alcohol to change the way I saw the world. And it did on a daily basis for a short period of time. It kept getting shorter. I was in my home that day, and we had only a few friends left, and we were going to have a little New Year's Eve party. We were going to go out to eat dinner, and we're going to come back early. I know why we're coming back early. Because sometimes when I get out and stay out too long, I'm really hard to get back home. So I know what we're doing. I'm on the drill. Then we're going to ask everybody to my house, and we're going to bring in the new year. I know it's going to work just that way, and by God, I'm going to make it work that way today, because I'm in a lot of trouble. I've been at a party a few days before that, and we have a highway that goes around Dallas called 635, which is a 6 or 8 lane highway. Cars driving 70 miles an hour. I went to this party and insisted on driving home at 35 miles an hour. And I wanted to be careful. My wife was in the car. Anyway, I was in trouble. And Billy, I decided that morning I might just have a little drink. Kind of, it was a kind of a festive occasion. So I was having a drink, and she walked by. She said, "Remember, tonight we're going to," I said, "I know, we're going to go out, we're going to have dinner, we're going to come back here, bring in the new year. I got it. Don't sweat it, I got it." She said, "Okay." And I had another drink and another. And I was being careful. And then I woke up in my chair and looked outside, and it was pitch black. And I looked over, and she was sitting in her little chair reading a little book. They read little books a lot of the time. And I said, "Billy, shouldn't we be going to dinner?" And she said, "Oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is?" And I looked at the clock, and it was about 10:15. I'd passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I had no excuse. I had no pressure. I wasn't mad at anybody. There wasn't a party. I had no excuse at all. I knew that my wife had to call those people and say, "You all go to dinner, and by the way, you can't come back to our house." And probably being a good black belt Al-Anon by that time, she told him why, because Jerry's passed out in his chair. That's what I thought anyway. And I got up and I went to the bar and I made myself a big drink. I wanted oblivion, and I got it. And on January the 1st, 1973, I sat on the edge of a bed and remembered what I'd done the night before. I had no blackout. And I was sick of me. I was sick of what I was. I was sick of what I'd become. I knew I was not responsible. I knew I'd embarrassed myself, and I was ashamed of myself. And it was January the 1st. And I thought, what are you going to do this year? Are you going to do the same thing you did last year? And I didn't want to do that. And I considered my options. What are my options? And the bottom line was, I didn't have any. I had only one, and that was to stop drinking. So I took a shower, got myself together, went in the kitchen where Billy was fixing breakfast or doing something. And I said, "I'm really sorry about last night." She was not impressed with my apology. She didn't even look around. And I said, "Billy, I'm going to try to quit drinking." And she was impressed. She ran over to the bookcase and picked up two books. She had a big blue book called Alcoholics Anonymous and a little 24-hour book, and she came trotting over and she said, "You may find these helpful. Would you like for me to call someone from Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I took the books and threw them against the wall and said, "Hell no. Hell no, I got myself in this mess, and by God, if anybody's going to get me out, it'll be me." That's the way West Texas men operate, by God, I'll tell you that. And she said something in Al-Anon. She did. I'll tell you what it was, and you'll recognize it for being something in Al-Anon. After I made the statement how it was going to be, she said, "You got it," and walked off. And I had it. I just didn't know I had it. And I began to try to stop drinking. And it was, you know, you think when you're doing something bad for yourself and you stop, it ought to get better, shouldn't it? Oh, my God, no. It got worse. I was shaking and shimmying and sweating and thought about drinking all the time. Wanted to drink. Didn't want to drink. Well, I got quick. I couldn't be in the right place. If I'm sitting down in a chair, I ought to be standing up. If I'm standing up, I ought to be outside walking around. If I'm outside walking around, I ought to be in laying down. I'm just moving and grooving. I didn't have anybody to talk to. But I hung in there tough. And at the end of the second day, at the end of the second day, I knew if I didn't get some relief, I was going to drink. So I decided I would call somebody. Couldn't call the Preston group because that's where Billy went to Al-Anon. And they would, she had poisoned the well there for sure. She the girl talks way too much. So I looked in the telephone book and I found the AA intergroup. That sounded like that might be kind of a collective place or something like that. So I called them. And I got a woman on the telephone who was the most insensitive human being I ever met. I said, I'm trying to quit drinking and I'm having a little trouble. She said, what's your name? I said, it doesn't matter what my name is. I'm just looking for some information. She said, are you going to AA meetings? And I said, I don't think I can do that because, first of all, I'm a pretty important lawyer. And number two, I haven't got time. I couldn't go to a meeting every day or anything like that. And she said, well, what have you been doing in the evening? I said, well, I've been drinking whiskey. She said, well, you're going to stop that, aren't you? And you'll have a lot of free time, won't you? So we began to discuss what kind of meeting I would like to go to. And she said, who would you like to be associated with? What would you like to have? And I said, well, I'd like to have one with college graduates. Near a country club. So if they saw me there, they would think I was going to the country club. And she said, we ain't got none like that. So we settled on one called the Town and Country Group. Sounded kind of woodsy. I thought everybody would come in a station wagon with paddling on the sides, you know. It wasn't like that at all. It was a little home group. Met once a week, whether they needed to or not. They had years and years of sobriety. Their baby, the one they call baby, had a year and a half. I couldn't think three more days, and they've got a year and a half. And they're talking to me about this thing. And my conclusion was, they can't be alcoholics like me. I'm barely able to get through the day without taking a drink. And some of those people have been sober 15, 20 years. They couldn't have a drinking problem like mine. But I kept going, hanging on day at a time, week at a time. Don't know how many weeks it was, two or three. And a guy walked in. Came from a heart treatment center called Heartview in South Carolina. His name was David P. David walked in. David had literature sticking out of every pocket. He had been locked up in some treatment center for 3 or 4 months. Something about he was unwilling to take a fourth step, whatever the hell that was. And he knew more about alcoholism than anybody I ever heard in my life. He had 6 months of sobriety. Man. I might could do that. So I listened carefully as he told them all about alcoholism and treatment and the steps and all that stuff. And when the meeting was over, he walked outside, and man, I'm right behind him. And we look at each other, and we're both quick. You know, we're still, we're pretty far up the scale. And I said, David, what do you think about this AA group in here? And he said, well, that's not for us. And he said, I said, that's what I thought. What do you think we'll do? He said, oh, we're going to go to AA. But we need a meeting every night. We need sponsors. We need to make coffee, whatever the hell that good that did would do. But that was one of the things he mentioned. And he said, we are going to have to change the way we think. And I said, where are we going to go? The miracle happened right there for me. And he said, well, I heard about a new group way out of North Dallas called the Alpha Group. Would you go out there with me tomorrow night? And I said, I'll check it out. And I'll call you. I was not sure where that was, and I needed to be sure where I was going to go to meetings. So I cased it just like I was going to rob it. First time I drove by, I was going about 50 miles an hour, and I just glanced at it, you know, at the side. Then I turned around and went back, and it was over the top of a convenience store. And I pulled in and stopped and checked up, and there's windows out there to see if there was any surveillance cameras or anybody sitting up there watching. And it was clear. So I went in and got a Slurpee or some damn thing and walked back out and checked it again. Still clear. Noticed there was a driveway on the side of the building, and I backed up and decided I'd check out to see what was behind it. And there it was. There were 6 parking places in the alley. I could climb the fire escape and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the way you got me. I didn't like you. I thought you had goofy things you did. Somebody would say, my name is Jerry, and everybody would say, hi, Jerry. I'm a cool, slick lawyer. You know about cool, don't you? That's the way I went to AA. I went in just at 8, got the hell out of there at 9 o'clock. But there was one woman there. I didn't like her at all. She was a dramatic woman. She would grab you and hug you at the drop of a hat. I mean, I didn't want to hug anybody. And after I went there for a few weeks, she said, walked up to me and she said, I want you to buy me some ice cream after the meeting. Will you do that? I thought, oh my God, what does that woman want with me? She was kind of a big shot there. Everybody kind of deferred to her. And I was afraid to say no. So I said, okay. She told me where to go, where to sit, what kind of ice cream to eat. And we talked for a minute. And she said, some bitch, I've been watching you. She said, I think you're going to make it. And I want to make it too. She said, I had 13 years of sobriety, and I got drunk and got on marijuana and pills and alcohol. And I've been out there for 4 years, and I'm back for about 8 or 10 months. And I need somebody to watch me and tell me when I'm getting off the beam. Would you do that for me? I said, I damn sure will. And she said, good, because that's what I'm going to do for you. Well, David showed up at that meeting, and the three of us really sponsored ourselves. We all had sponsors, but we talked over our problems every day, the problems we were having in the steps. We wanted to work the steps. And in a little while, my thinking began to change. People stopped me on the street and said, we don't know what's happening with you, but whatever it is, keep it up because it's working. I had a young fellow I met up here years later, and he offered me a beer, and I told him I don't drink beer or anything anymore. And he said, when did you stop that? And I said, oh, how many years ago it was? And he said, I know when that happened. And I said, oh, no, you don't know when that happened. He used to come to my office on a daily basis, and he worked for me. I said, no, you don't know when that happened. He said, yes, I do. He said, that happened in the fall of 1973. And I said, well, how do you know that? And he said, well, I used to come in your office every morning and talk to you about what we're doing, and you look like death eating a cracker. And one day I walked in, and there was a different man sitting across the desk from me. I always wondered, what in the hell happened to you? I became attracted to the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They didn't care how much money I made. They didn't care whether I had a swimming pool, what kind of car I drove. They only cared about what I was doing in the program, whether or not I was progressing, whether I had a sponsor, what step I was on. And they really cared. They really cared. And I began to think, there may be something here. There may be something here. And I decided to go for it. The first amend I ever made, I mailed to my mother and father a copy of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and told them, this is the way I'm going to try to live the rest of my life. I know I've been a disappointment to you, but this is the way I'm going to try to go. And my God, they thought Alcoholics Anonymous was the best thing since sliced bread. I began to do the things they told me to do. I began to recognize, and I didn't like the idea, did not like the idea that I was bodily and mentally different from anybody else. But I began to think that maybe I was. Maybe I really was. I began to read that book. They were always quoting the damn book to me. And I'm a lawyer, and I don't know, like to be misled. So I read the damn book so I could see if they were telling me the truth about what it said. And they were. I read the book, made a decision that I was going to go forward with this thing. Began to understand. It said in that book that alcoholism centers in the mind. I made some sense to me. That business about taking a drink, that was physical, to drink again. But there was that obsession behind there that had to be in your mind. And I began to try to, and I understand now that you're not going to think yourself sober, but you damn sure going to have to do some thinking to take the right kind of action. And that's what happened to me. I had sponsors who helped me do that. The slogans we have are ways to guide our thinking to something that's helping us solve the problem, I think. That's my view of the thing. And I began to try to work on my thinking. My sponsor told me, I told him I was thinking a lot about drinking. He said, I'll tell you what you do, Jerry. When you're in a meeting at night and somebody says something that you like or believe, remember that. The next day when you're thinking about taking a drink, put that thought out of your mind and think about what you heard in the meeting. And I began to do that. I even began to write down those thoughts I had in a notebook. And I filled that notebook up with important things that you all told me as we went along. And I began to tell everybody else those things because I knew it made me look smart. I had a hard time with the fourth step. I really didn't see much need for that because, you know, I told you I'd been to a psychiatrist. I was in a bunch of radicals. Hell, they were all taking four steps and fifth steps. So I took part of one. I wrote down the resentments, which is a thought, a memory. I wrote down fear, which is a thought about the future, worrying about the future. I skipped sex because I was married and not messing around, and it did not matter what happened there. I didn't need to write that down. And I did my steps. I did the first two parts of that fourth step. And my sponsor had me come in and go over that with him. I asked him if he ever found it necessary to take a fourth step, and he said, yes, of course I did. And I said, well, did you find it necessary to take a fifth step? And he said, well, yes, I did. My sponsor did. I said, funny. I took it in there to him, and he looked at it, thumbed it through it at me. He said, did you write this down? I said, yeah. And he threw it in the wastebasket. He said, that's the past. That's the past. We're going to talk about where we're going from here. Well, if he took a fifth step with his sponsor that way, what do you think he'd do with me? Of course he's going to throw that damn thing away. We're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the important things in the future. And I went in and I gave him my little book. And he says, that's your book? Yes. I wrote it all. And he looked at it a minute and he said, are you going to read this to me or am I going to read it to you? What I feared had come upon me. I went on through the steps. A little bit later, I was asked to sponsor a guy, and he did his fourth and fifth step real early, earlier than was necessary, quicker than I did. And by then, I felt like I belonged to AA when I got through with that. And then I went and started a little meeting in our group on fourth step. I wanted to help everybody else. I was, you know, if you had a cuticle that was bothering you, I'd say, have you done a fourth step? And and I gave a lot of good advice, and they asked me, what'd you write about sex? And I said, not much, not much. And I knew I needed to. So I expanded the idea of sex to more than just sexual relations. I wrote about how I'd use sex in my life. I wrote about how I asked those same questions that they give us in the book about every important relationship in my life, where I disappointed people, where I'd harmed anybody. So I got a pretty good dose. And when this fellow that I was telling you about, my first sponsee, wanted to do his fifth step, we did it. I asked him how he felt about that. He said, well, feel pretty good. And I said, well, you sound a little hesitant about that. And he said, well, I feel like you know everything in the world about me and I don't know anything about you. What I'd really like is if you'd do your fifth step with me. I've never been able to command any respect from people I sponsor. They're pushy as hell, and I don't know whether it's people I draw or whether it's just me. So I went through that, and I went through the rest of the steps. I had trouble with God. I'd given up with God a long time ago. As a little boy, I went to church all the time with my parents, and I asked the preachers lots of questions, and the preachers couldn't answer my questions to my satisfaction. And I had doubts, and I could not. They told me, he said, what do you do? I asked them, what do you do when you have trouble believing? And they said, well, you have faith. And I've decided I would have faith. I've sat down in a chair and say, okay, I'm going to have faith. Nothing happened. And so finally I confessed to one of my sponsors or one of the people in the group, and I said, you know, I don't have any faith. And they said, we don't give a damn whether you got any faith or not. I said, you don't? What about this God things and all them steps? He said, you're going to have to figure out what you believe about God. But let me tell you something. What we want you to do is what the book tells you to do. If you do what that book tells you to do every step of the way, when you get to the end of those steps, you will have faith. You will have had a spiritual experience. They showed me in the book where a valid spiritual experience will change your attitude about life, about your fellows, and about God's universe. And I did that. I changed the word God. I know I didn't change it. I defined it to whatever works in Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw people getting well that really shouldn't have made it at all. But they were getting well. They changed. They became different people. And that was happening to me on a regular basis. People were pointing out it was different. I was up in Colorado, up here one year, two or three years in the program. And one of my big issues was anger. It was just below the surface all the time. That went back before I ever took a drink. I was full of anger. And just any little thing that'd come along, I would blow up like Mount Vesuvius and You'd have to deal with it, and I'd have to deal with it. And this guy was in a fishing tackle shop up here, and I saw him, and I walked up, and I said, "Hi, Bill." He said, "Are you Jerry Jones?" I said, "Yeah. You know, I went fishing with you. I've been to church boards with you. Yeah, I'm Jerry Jones. What happened to you?" And I said, "Well, I've got a little grayer headed, and some of it's come out, and, you know, I've aged a little bit." He said, "No, no. You're not angry anymore. I want to know what happened. I never worked a day on anger, but I worked on something else. I worked on peace. I worked on lack of fear. I worked on love. I worked on things that are not included in anger. And because I was working on this, this diminished and went away. Can it come back? Sure it can. I can still go off like Mount Vesuvius when I'm off the track. But largely, my life has changed to such an extent that it's just not the same at all." And then I got to sponsoring people. God, I had fun doing that. That first sponsor, I followed him around just like, you know, daily, nightly. "Are you doing? Have you got a job yet? Why did you quit the last one? What are you going to do? You don't have any money. What's wrong with your car?" You know, I just was absorbed with this guy. He just drove me crazy, you know. I'd get him a job and he'd quit the next day. It was really something else. So I finally decided I couldn't live my life through him. And I began to back off and let him make his mistakes and be available to him when he came along. At the end of the second year, I was sober. David and the lady and I were very active in that group. And we sponsored damn near everybody that came in. I had 25 people I was trying to sponsor when I had 2 years of sobriety. Way, way too many. And they began to get drunk despite my best efforts. And began to encourage people to go to other people and get sponsees. Jean Coffin was the girl's name. Great and lovely lady. My life has been really good. How are we doing, Lee? I got 2 minutes. Let me give you some examples, big examples to me, about what happened in my life. When my mind changed, when I got new thoughts, when I took the action directed by the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I got sober, my mother contracted ovarian cancer. And they operated, and they thought they got it all. And then a little bit later, they called and said, "We found another lump, and we're going to have to operate again." And my mother called me and asked me if I would come up. So I went up to Clovis, New Mexico, where my mother was. And I didn't take a bottle to drink. I didn't take anything to drink. My mother didn't like drinking. She never had a drink. And now she was on that farm where I worked when I was a kid until I was 21. She helped me as much as anybody could. She and Dad and I we had a 1,500-acre farm, and we did the work on that thing. And she was such a great gal. And I really, really loved her. So I went up there, and they took her in the hospital, in the operating room, and operated, and the old family doctor went in to observe the surgery. And they hadn't been gone any time when he came out and walked over to Dad and I, and he said, "Boys, it ain't any good. That cancer's everywhere in her abdomen. She'll be dead in a year." And it was like somebody turned a switch on me. I just turned around and walked out of that hospital, got in a car, went to a liquor store, bought a bunch of vodka, and began to drink it. I drank it in coffee. I drank it in anything I could get it in. She got out of surgery. She went through recovery. She didn't die that day anyway. And she She knew I was drinking. Everybody knew I was drunk. They sent me home because I was of no use to anybody. I was a problem. I came in, got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and had about 5 years sobriety. Mother, by that time, had many years of what we thought was health, cured. And she called me again one day, and she said, Jerry, they found another lump in my stomach. They're going to operate again. Would you come up? I said, you betcha. And I went up there, and I went to the hospital room where she was, and we had a nice visit. Everything was easy and comfortable with us, and our amends had been made, and we were happy one with the other. She said, Jerry, I want you to get the family in here. I want to talk to them. So I rounded up everybody and got them inside, and she said, folks, this is going to be real hard for me. I've been fighting this thing for a long, long time, and I don't know how this is going to come out. I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to do the very best I can, but I may not make it. And it's going to be very hard on me any way it goes. And she said, it's going to be hard on you too while this is going on. I said, what you do is you lean on Jerry. He'll be your strength. And it did. My dad blew a great big ulcer in his stomach. They had to take out most of his stomach. Didn't get to go to the funeral. I had to arrange the funeral, the pallbearers, the whole nine yards. And it was a week or two after the funeral when she was buried and I was back in Dallas that it occurred to me, not once, not one second while all of that was going on, did I ever think about taking a drink. Just didn't occur to me. Today, I see people drink whiskey. And my thought when I see it is, thank God I don't have to do that anymore. I am just so, I don't have any, I'm sure there in the beginning, I envied people that could drink, but I don't care whether they drink or not anymore. I don't want anything to do with it. I'm through, I hope. And I'm going to keep doing what they tell me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous again. My dad died about a year and a half later, had a ruptured aorta. Waited until 6 o'clock. It started about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he waited until 6 because he knew I didn't like to get up early. Called me to come get him. In about 24 hours, they'd figured out what it was. And the doctor said he was going to have to, the only thing he had could offer was to crack his chest and go in and try to repair that aorta. He said it was a heroic surgery. A doctor I sponsored was standing there, and when the guy left, he said, I think it's idiotic surgery. I said, well, Dad's made his decision all his life. I'm going to ask him what he wants to do. So I went in and told him what his situation was and said, what do you want, surgery or not? And he said, oh, hell no. I'll die before they get me on the operating table. Then he stopped, and he looked at me and said, how long have I got? Billy was there. My daughter had some kind of a hunch that something was going on. She was at A&M in college, 200 or 300 miles away. She had driven up all late in the night to get up there. She was there. My son was doing his residency there, or part of his training there, I should say, and he was there. We were all standing around the bed when Dad said, how long have I got? And I said, I just don't know, Dad. He stuck out his hands and said, Jerry, been pretty good. Yeah. He never told me specifically he loved me. I got to tell him 1,000 times that I loved him. But it's been pretty good. It was good enough. It was good enough. Wonderful things happen to you. Things happen to you that you don't even can even imagine that they're going to be that way. I've had all kinds of deaths in my family and my friends. A little while back, I got leukemia after I retired. And I worried a lot about that. You go back, when somebody tells you you've got something like leukemia, you go back and you revisit your idea about God, about what it's going to be like in the hereafter. And I thought about it every morning when I just woke up. It's like she's going to say, this is the day the Lord has made. I woke up saying, is this going to be the day I'm going to die? And how is it going to be? And I sat on the edge of the bed one morning and I thought, you know, I've screwed up a lot of good days with this start on the day. I ain't going to mess up another damn day thinking about when I'm going to die. I'll know when it happens. And I had a couple of years where I haven't got many vital parts left in my body. I've got enough to keep me going, apparently. I don't know if there's many more things they can take out, but my life is good. My life is good. My children have been successful. They're raising good families. I'm married to a wonderful woman who finally got over that Al-Anon stuff, felt like she was passing on. That's not true. I just told a lie right there. She has not got over that Al-Anon stuff, whether I want her to or not. She still has got her own mind, does what she thinks is right. When I retired, I started building a lake house where we were going to go and retire. I thought she was going with me. When I was about halfway through and had spent a whole bunch of money, she came walking in the room crying. And I said, what's wrong? She said, you're going to make me sell my house. My home, I think is the way she put it. I said, oh, buddy, I haven't said anything about selling your home. She said, I don't want to sell my home. I don't want to move to Whitney, Texas, whether it's the A capital of the world or not. So we got a house in Dallas, and we got a house in Whitney. She comes down and visits with me on after Wednesday, every Wednesday afternoon. She's there, stays until sometimes Sunday morning. Then a lot of weekends, I go to Dallas. There's a lot of things to fix around her house. I gave her the damn thing, but she can't fix anything. That's as near as I can tell. It's been a good ride. I've never wondered what my purpose in life was since I got sober in program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I once was out in 2 minutes. I knew I would do it. I had a thought one day that how wonderful it was I was sober, but you know, I was feeling kind of bad about it. And a woman confessed that she had a worse situation in cancer than I did. And the thought came to me, ain't you got it tough, cowboy? Ain't you got it tough? I heard that when Lois Wilson died, just before she died, the gentleman who was running the General Service Office went to see her and told her that he came because he wanted to tell her, wanted to thank her for what she had done for Alcoholics Anonymous, that she had saved our lives. And she had a little pad. She couldn't write. She had tubes and all that. She wrote, not me, God. And the guy said, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, you got me. That's right. It's God. But Lois, you were the person who brought it to us. And she wrote again, and so are you. So are you. Texas did a pretty good job of bringing people up here this year. Some of you other states are going to have to get your ass in gear and bring some people up in this church. Thank you.